you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com, and she's also the co-host of the Breakfast All Day YouTube and podcast series. As well with us this week, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor, Peter Rayner. And we begin with Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, the film directed by Gil Kenan, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Jason Reitman. You might recall back in 1984, the first of the Ghostbusters was directed by Jason's father, Ivan Reitman. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Peter.
Well, it's been 40 years since the first one, and the time flies when you're not always having fun, as in this movie. I didn't see the last one. I just thought it was, you know, kind of missable. And the one before, the all-female
one. Yeah, the all-women one.
I thought was not good. And I don't think this is particularly good either. It harkens back to all of the other Ghostbusters movies, especially the first one. And you've got, you know, Ernie Hudson and Dan Aykroyd and Annie Potts and Bill Murray as a 3-second cameo in it, you know, pretty much. And, so there's a lot of self-referential backslapping in this film. But overall, I think the problem for me with the film is that there's too much going on. It's like the filmmakers couldn't figure out what story to tell or what couple of stories to tell. So they just threw everything into the mix. Paul Rudd is this sort of stepfathery guy who's paired with Carrie Coon, they're very affable actors, and you know, their kids are it reminded me a little bit of Spy Kids, this whole movie. Mm. You know, I mean, it's a kind of cheesiness to it, and a sense in which, you know, they're just sort of throwing everything against the wall to see what hits, and the whole Frozen Empire thing doesn't really play out very well either. The big climax, I thought, was kind of a bust. It's nice to see Dan Aykroyd, you know, playing the occult bookseller role, and Patton Oswalt's very funny. And, you know, there's funny cameos throughout. I'll just say, you know, it may not be totally in bounds, but, you know, Bill Murray is maybe in the movie for 5 minutes. I think he worked for 2 days. He probably got millions and millions of dollars for this. I don't blame him for that, but he could have put a little bit more into the role. It looks like he doesn't want to be in this movie, and you know, for a paycheck performance, one expects a little bit more, particularly given the lineage of this film.
Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Christy.
Yeah, I did see Ghostbusters Afterlife, and I think you have to understand why Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon and McKenna Grace and Finn Wolfhard are now in New York taking over the firehouse, busting ghosts. This is a better job than that film of blending the old and the new. I hated Afterlife. I thought it was all just wallowing in nostalgia, just shamelessly like lingering on, ooh, look, there's the car. Ooh, look, they're wearing proton packs. Here's stuff you know. Here's your childhood all over again. This is a better job of moving in a more sprightly way between the old and the new. But the McKenna Grace character is super interesting. She's this science whiz kid. These are the descendants of Spengler, and so the Harold Ramis character. So she wants to bust ghosts with the family, but she's 15, so she can't. That's one of many, many different plots going on here. It is too crammed. There is too much story. The whole reason that things get icy, it gets explained to us, but is extremely convoluted, and I don't totally understand it or think it works.
I don't
works.
Think they did either.
Yeah, and then how do you fight it? Like the thing with Kumail Nanjiani, how does that work? But Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon, as you say, are really likable together. What they do with Carrie Coon, though, is a travesty. Like one of the best actresses working today, deeply talented, so versatile, and she's just relegated to being like the no-nonsense harried mom here. Sort of a thankless role for her. This is okay. I gave it 2 stars out of 4 on RogerEbert.com. It's better than its predecessor, but like, can we just not wallow in nostalgia? Can we just move on? They have the IP. Take that and do something new with it.
We're talking about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, directed by Gil Kenan, who co-wrote it with Jason Reitman. It's rated PG-13. It's in wide release. The horror film Immaculate stars Sydney Sweeney and Alvaro Morte. Michael Mohan directed. Andrew Lobel is the screenwriter. Christy, please tell us about Immaculate.
This movie is nutty, and it's going to make people very, very angry. I think there's imagery, Catholic.
You say that with delight.
There's Catholic iconography here, and the way that it is used, I think, is going to anger a lot of people, but that comes down the road. First, you have Sydney Sweeney as this devout young woman named Cecilia. She grew up outside of Detroit, but she is traveling to this remote nunnery in Italy, very scenic, very craggy. We know from the opening sequence something horrible has happened there, but she is young and plucky and full of promise, and she shows up, and this is her calling. And she hasn't realized this, but we realize from the very beginning that this is a weird place and something's going on here. She becomes pregnant. This is not a spoiler.
Given the title, right, this is not a shock.
It's the titular role, as they say, in Lady Bird. She becomes pregnant. And so the question is, how did this happen? She's a virgin. She's a nun. Is an Immaculate Conception. So they all revere her as this sacred vessel because of it, but darker stuff happens from there. It's pretty moody in like a gothic kind of horror way for a while. There are way too many jump scares given how effective the atmosphere is. And then in the third act, it goes totally crazy in ways that I wish it had for a while leading up to it. They sort of save it all up, and there's one tremendous long single take where the camera is just on Sydney Sweeney's face, and it is gory and intense, and you're going to hold your breath wondering what's going to happen. They go to places that are very daring, and I applaud them for it.
Immaculate, the horror film that we're talking about, Peter.
Yeah, well, the conception of this movie is very gory. Apparently, this was like a passion project of Sydney Sweeney's for some time. It's a little odd to think of it in those terms, but I guess to each his own or her own. I wasn't nuts about it. I thought there are way too many jump scares in it, and you can see them coming, and even when you jump, it's too much, and at its best, I think it's sort of like a cross between. I mean, there's certainly a lot of Rosemary's Baby in here. There's also sort of a cross between The Nun Story and Eraserhead,
That's the quote of the day, Peter.
Yeah, you should not see this movie if you're pregnant, which is what they said about Eraserhead as well. There's a lot of stuff going on in this movie, but it all seems to be on a sort of horror level, a gory, gross-out horror level with, all of this, Catholic symbology in it. But it doesn't go very deep. And I guess it's unfair to think in this way, but I was hoping that it would be more like Carrie, which I thought was also really scary, really bloody, really powerful, but also had this whole other undertone,
psychological
aspect, the fundamentalist mother and Carrie and all of the Catholic imagery in that really resonated in a way that here is just sort of pro forma. So, I think it for what it is, it's going to get people jumping out of their seats, and the scare factor is there. But it does, I think, go over the line in ways that aren't particularly profitable.
What did you think of Sydney Sweeney's performance?
She's great in this. She can do anything. I mean, between the screwball comedy of Anyone But You, and then if you saw the movie Reality on HBO, where she played Reality Winner, a totally stripped down minimalist performance, this like that relies a lot on her face, on her eyes, on her being able to hold the frame and carry us with her as she goes through this increasingly intense realm. So I think she's very good. What'd you think?
Yeah, I thought she was pretty good. I having just seen her brief before in the Saturday Night Live hosting and all of these some comments against that because most of the skits were based on how she looks. I think in this movie she certainly doesn't play off of that. It's an entirely different realm for her. And I think, she does a good job. It helps in this kind of scenario if you're somewhat not blank-faced, but not overly emotive and tipping off the audience all the time as to how you're feeling.
We're talking about the film Immaculate. It's a horror film starring Sydney Sweeney, Michael Mohan, the director, Andrew Lobell, the screenwriter. It's rated R. You can see Immaculate in select theaters. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Roadhouse, a new version of that film. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. We'll also hear about the Australian crime mystery Limbo, starring Simon Baker, and a biography looking at the life of Shirley Chisholm, who was the first Black congresswoman and the first Black woman to run for president of the United States. That all comes up on Film Week here on LAist 89.3. Back with you in just a moment.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle with critics Peter Rayner and Christy Lemire. Mind you, in case you missed our two films we reviewed to this point, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire or the horror film Immaculate with Sydney Sweeney, you can hear in their entirety the full time of Film Week wherever you get your podcasts or at LAist.com. Next up is Roadhouse. We have a new version of the film. The original goes back to 1989. The new Roadhouse stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. It's directed by Doug Liman, written by Anthony Bagarossi and Chuck Mondry. Christy?
This movie is so fun because it's a Roadhouse movie that knows it's a Roadhouse movie, and it has so much fun with that. The 89 Roadhouse starring Patrick Swayze is so of its time and so serious and so macho, and this just plays with all of that, and it's hilarious, and I am shocked at how much I enjoyed myself because I'm like, does the world really need a new Roadhouse movie? And yes, apparently we do, and here it is. I wish it were playing in theaters. It's only streaming on Prime Video. Doug Liman, who directed it, was very vocal about the fact that he thought it was going to be playing theatrically as well. And I wish it were. It played at South by Southwest. This will play like gangbusters under the right circumstances. So Jake Gyllenhaal is Dalton, not unlike Patrick Swayze. He is a notoriously legendary, mythical figure for his prowess as a fighter. And we see him in the beginning. Here he's a UFC fighter in the beginning. That's slightly different. But the spine of this is exactly the same as the original Roadhouse. He is asked to go to this rowdy dive bar and kind of get things in order because there's just too much fighting going on. Here, the owner is Jessica Williams, who is so funny. She has great chemistry with Jake Gyllenhaal here. And so he's got to go down to the Florida Keys to this rowdy place. And the process, he crosses paths with the local bad guy who runs things. Here he's played by Billy Magnuson, who's very funny. He once again falls in love with a doctor. Here she's played by Gabriella Melchior, who's very good. What is different here is this movie has a really cheeky, understated sense of humor. It sneaks up on you. Jake Gyllenhaal as Dalton is so funny and like smart and clever in understated ways and kind of playful with the guys that he's about to beat up. And over again, I just laughed out loud. I really, really enjoyed this. Doug Liman has a history of doing some really big action movies like The Bourne Identity and it's now called Live, Die, Repeat with Tom Cruise and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So you've got stuff with like exploding boats. You know, if you want that, that is there. But a lot of folks are going to tune into this to watch Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor beat each other up. I am not a UFC fan. Larry, I don't know if you are a UFC fan.
No, really? No.
A lot of people, though, are going to be very excited about this. I didn't necessarily need that. And I would say the last half hour of this entirely two-hour-long movie gets a little repetitive for me. But I had a lot of fun. It's really silly and playful.
And as you say, some viewers, that's what they're going to be waiting for, the fights.
Right.
That's really what sells the ticket for them.
Does Conor McGregor have a future as an actor?
As an actor, he is a great fighter. I will say, if you want to see naked Conor McGregor.
Well elided.
There's a lot of naked Conor McGregor. But, you know, he shows up and does what he has to do.
We're talking about Roadhouse. This is the third Roadhouse movie, the original 1989, and then there was a direct-to-DVD sequel in 2006. Doug Liman directing, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. Roadhouse is streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Limbo, an Australian crime drama, stars Simon Baker and Natasha Wanaganin. The film is written and directed by Ivan Sen. Peter, what did you think of Limbo?
This is a strong movie. It's shot entirely in black and white. It's very austerely shot. It's set in a remote area of the outback that was sort of an opal mining town, and now it's just sort of full of craters and caves where people mostly live because it's so hot. Simon Baker is a detective who visits the community because there's a 20-year-old cold case. A young woman was disappeared. An Aboriginal woman, indigenous woman, went missing 20 years ago, and it was never solved, and the case was, just sort of set aside. And he's there to see if they can reopen the case, not so much solve it, but just even get to the point of should we reopen it. And he's a very complex character. He's, a former a drug officer who we first seen in the movie. He's shooting up in his quote hotel room. So he visits the family of the disappeared woman, who really want nothing to do with him. When he sees the brother, the first wonderfully played by Rob Collins, Collins says to him, "I don't talk to police, especially white ones." So that tells you a lot. And the movie doesn't overemphasize the white supremacy aspect of all of this, but it's very much in the DNA of this film. And in going around and talking to the different family members, you get a real overview of the struggles that these indigenous people have gone through. And Natasha Wanganin, who's the sister, is particularly good, I think, in her performance. It's a strong movie. It really there are very few movies that I've seen from Australia that really play this story up about the horrors of this. The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, I think, was a really good one. But this one is really powerful.
Limbo is the film we're talking about. Christy?
I thought it was great, too. It's so strikingly shot because it is shot in black and white, as Peter mentioned, and because the topography is so stark, it feels like it all takes place on the moon. Like, it's a beautiful bleakness to it, and, it's so barren and so arid and so spare that, if there's a single car driving down a road, there's just nothing on either side of it as far as the eye can see. But then there are these caves, and people live in the caves, and so the use of lighting over and over again, there's establishing shots where I was like, wow, that's beautiful. Wow, that's beautiful. Because either the light's coming through the cave from the outside, or they're using shadow in a way that is very ominous and mysterious. And Simon Baker is great in this. I've never seen him do anything like this. He's an incredibly handsome man, and he is so stripped down with like a buzzed haircut and all these tats. He looks like Bryan Cranston in Breaking Bad. Does he not? He has like all these neck tats,
yeah,
and the glasses.
He's unrecognizable. Mentalist, forget it.
And intentionally, they don't let us see him full on until almost the very end. You see him, his head's down a lot. There's a lot going on with self-confidence and his sense of purpose, and you see him from the side quite a bit, and eventually you do see him full on, and it's striking. When you finally see him in full, you realize that there has been an occurrence that has come to him, and he's not a white savior here. Quite the opposite. I think that he maybe becomes something close to saved in his interactions with these families.
Yeah, you don't really... You discover about halfway through that you probably aren't going to figure out who did what. You know, it's not that kind of movie. It's not a whodunit. It's much more incisive than that. I saw the film recently on the big screen. Mark Johnson, who was not involved but is a friend of Simon Baker, did an interview, and Johnson said at one point, you know, I watched this movie in black and white, and it never occurred to me really that, hey, this is black and white, because the setting is so austere that you just think of it. I mean, even if it was shot in color, it would be black and white, you know, which I thought was a really good point.
We're talking about Limbo. Simon Baker stars, Ivan Sen, the writer-director. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Shirley is a biopic about Shirley Chisholm, first black congresswoman and the first black woman to run for president of the United States. Regina King stars John Ridley, who's been a guest on Air Talk with us a number of times over the years, is the writer and director of Shirley, Christie.
This is a very solidly made, well-cast, well-acted biopic. It doesn't really do a whole lot that's terribly different in terms of structure, in terms of tone, but it doesn't really have to. It's such an inspiring story, and it wasn't that long ago. It was 50 years ago, 52 years ago, but still necessary to hear about this woman's bravery and her trailblazing history that she's left for so many other people in politics. So Regina King is Shirley Chisholm. We see her, you know, begin her congressional career, that freshman picture on the steps there at Congress, and she stands out. It's all white men and her, but from the very beginning, she's totally undaunted, but in ways that are like quietly powerful, right? Like there's this quiet kind of simmering, bubbling, not fury, but like sense of purpose, like sense of necessity to be a voice for the people in Brooklyn in her district. And just what happens when she is persuaded to run for president and does not have a chance, and she knows this, and that's not the point, though. It's like what this means in terms of representation, in terms of giving hope to other people. It's this fantastic supporting cast. You have Lucas Hedges, Lance Reddick in one of his last roles, Andre Holland, Terrence Howard, like everyone is great in this. The production and the costume design are spot on. She looks just like Shirley Chisholm. It's amazing. And then John Ridley, who won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, does some interesting things in terms of like framing, like where he will place her in the frame in terms of trying to indicate her isolation in a way that's quiet, in a way that's artful. So he makes some interesting artistic decisions here that are unexpected, but it's kind of just a solid biopic.
We'll come back and hear what Peter Rayner has to say about the biopic Shirley, starring Regina King as Shirley Chisholm, John Ridley, the writer-director. It's rated PG-13. It's streaming on Netflix. We'll also hear about the documentary Remembering Gene Wilder. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3, and we remind you the full hour of Film Week available to you wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to it there or listen at LAist.com.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle with Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. We're right in the midst of a review of the biopic Shirley, starring Regina King as the first black congresswoman, Shirley Chisholm, and the first black woman to run for president of the United States. John Ridley, the writer-director. Peter, what did you think?
Well, you know, it's an admirable effort, and certainly Shirley Chisholm deserves a biopic. The problem I have with this film is similar to the one that I had with Rustin recently, with Coleman Domingo. You've got some terrific performances, including a terrific central performance, but somehow it just seems like there's a very dutiful aspect to the way the story is told. You know, all right, then this happened. You know, they had this blow up. The there was this argument, and it's all kind of sketched out in a way that made me want to feel as if, you know, I'd like to see a documentary about her life, because I think that would be much more involving and real. And when they do show pictures of her, of the real Shirley Chisholm at the end, you know, you feel like, aha, you know, that's the real person, even though Regina King is so good in it. I mean, the whole cast, it's marvelous cast. You know, there's also Brian Stokes Mitchell is in it, and others that Christy mentioned. But I do feel that it doesn't really... The political stuff, all of the political infighting that goes on, seemed to me less interesting than the domestic drama that she had with her husband. You know, Michael Cherry plays her husband, and the scenes between them and the sort of growing separation between them, I thought was in some ways the most interesting and emotional part of the movie. And I wish there'd been more of that. But, you know, instead we have a kind of, you know, Cook's tour of her political life with all of the signposts laid out. And, you know, it's worth seeing, and the performances are strong. I just feel it's a little bit too, you know, cookie cutter.
We're talking about Shirley, the biopic starring Regina King, rated PG-13. It's streaming on Netflix. The documentary Remembering Gene Wilder is directed by Rob Frank. And I just want to say as a premise, Gene Wilder is one of my favorite guests. Aww. In all the years I've been on Air Talk. He and I had such an incredible conversation in studio. And it was just like everything else kind of fell away. And at the end of it, he was the last interview of the show. He sat, you know, right where you are, Peter, and he said, "That's the best interview I have ever had." Aww. And he stayed for half an hour afterwards, and we just talked. And he gave me a hug at the end before he left. One of the most memorable experiences I've ever had with a guest on Air Talk was Gene Wilder.
Wow.
So how was the documentary?
Go ahead, Peter.
Well, he mentions you, Larry.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Dedicated to Larry Mantle.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, it's as a documentary, it's as a piece of work, I thought it was, you know, pretty okay. You know, there's a lot of... mostly, you know, laudatory. It's a love fest. You know, there's a lot of talking heads with a lot of the usual suspects, of course, Mel Brooks and, you know, Carol Kane and others. That's all interesting, and it's good to see them all there. I mean, I love Gene Wilder. I thought he remains one of my favorite performers. His meltdowns, no one could do hysterics like Gene Wilder. You know, I mean, starting with the producers. My blue blanket, you know, everything. I mean, most of that is in this movie. Some, like, Can Start the Revolution Without Me is not in here. You know, they don't really, you know, they don't go, he was married four times. They don't really deal with the first two. They don't deal much with his career in the 90s. The anecdote is given that when he was a little kid, his mother was very sick. She had a bad heart. And the doctor said to young Gene, you know, don't upset her in any way, you know, or she might die, which is a horrible thing to lay on a kid, you know. So, you know, calling Dr. Freud, you know, that's probably one reason why he became a comic was, you know, to make everybody laugh. But at the same time, this kind of hysterical, you know, craziness that's inside of him that keeps coming out, I think was sort of a reaction, you know, to all of that, you know, don't upset people, you know. But just to see the clips of him and Young, and also, you know, he co-wrote Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, that's right.
And what comes out in the movie is the putting on the Ritz number.
Yes.
With Peter Boyle was Gene Wilder's idea.
Really, I assumed that was Mel Brooks.
Me too. And he says that Mel Brooks thought it was a terrible idea, And then when they said, well, all right, we'll do it. And then he said, it turns out it's the best thing in the movie. Yeah.
We're talking about Remembering Gene Wilder, the documentary. Christy?
It's a very lovely film. It's very warm and affectionate and so many great anecdotes. And I came to appreciate his artistry on a whole different level, just as an actor, as a human being, where he found his inspiration from. It's a lot of interviews with him. And also his audiobook provides a through line as the narration, which is nice, because it makes you feel like he's taking your hand and walking you through this. So what happens so often when there's a documentary about somebody, you know, when the person, him or herself, is involved, or when the family estate gives the okay, it tends to be, you know, kind, kind of kid gloves. This is not in any way uncovering anything shocking or inappropriate about Gene Wilder. This is a loving tribute to his career. I learned so much about moments that we just take for granted in film. The introduction to him in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the way that he walks out, like what that came from, how he ended up in Blazing Saddles, like all these roles that are iconic roles of his, we learn great little details about. And they also talk about just as a presence, like those eyes. I'm sure Larry, looking across the table at him here, like those eyes must have been mesmerizing to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he was such a companionable performer. A lot of great comics, are basically acting, doing solos, and they don't really work with the other person because they're doing their thing. But with Gene Wilder, you know, he paired so marvelously with
Zero Mostel,
with Richard Pryor. You know, I mean, he just teamed with anybody well.
Yeah, we're talking about Remembering Gene Wilder, the documentary directed by Rob Frank. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. and their Town Center 5 location in Encino. It's unrated. Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World is a comedy from Romania. The film is screening at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. Peter?
Yeah, this is a very strange movie by this occult director, Radu Jude, who's got a lot of experience. Jude, who's had a lot of festival exposure. It's set in Bucharest. The woman named Angela is a sort of an Uber driver, but she also works at this multinational company that is trying to put out a kind of safety video for their people about, you know, what you shouldn't do in the workplace. And so she goes around and visits all these people who are all, you know, in wheelchairs and whatnot from workplace injuries, and films their stories. And then the company is going to pick the one that's most likely to, you know, get people to. It's a very strange movie because it's sort of bifurcated between that story and an actual footage from a 1981 Romanian film that was shot in color as opposed to the black and white stuff that isn't. And it interplays the two in ways that are very consciously Godardian. This film is one of, you know, I thought Jean-Luc Godard's influence had been kind of waning in the art world, but it's back with a real force in this movie. It's worth seeing. There's a 45-minute single take scene at the end, filming one of the guys in a wheelchair for this mock video. That is quite extraordinary and is sort of typical of Romanian movies like RMN, which seem to, you know, like have half-hour single takes, you know. But I should also say, just for a tourism point of view, there ought to be a few movies from Romania that are scenic. I mean, this, you know,
it's pretty bleak.
I've never seen a movie from Romania that did not look incredibly bleak. Just saying.
Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, Romanian comedy, written and directed by Radu Jude. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. It's unrated. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Peter Rayner, Christy Lemire, our critics. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. The Australian horror film Late Night with the Devil is written and directed by Cameron Cairns and Colin Cairns, who were brothers. Christy?
My favorite movie of the week. I love this movie. So it's so good. It does what it does so well. It takes pieces of things we've seen before and executes them so masterfully into something totally original and cool. It is 1977, and it's Halloween, and David Desmalchin plays this late-night talk show host named Jack Delroy, who is a perpetual second-place runner to Johnny Carson. Whatever he does, he cannot beat Carson's ratings, and that's been nagging at him, and so he's been doing increasingly wild things in the name of trying to get viewers. On Halloween night, he invites this paranormal investigator to come on with this teenage girl who maybe possessed by the devil, and they bring her on stage and try to commune with Satan, and what happens is so wild, but it takes a while to get there, and they really expertly set up this whole setting. First of all, what we are watching is supposedly the lost footage of this episode, right? So it's like a found footage movie, which we've seen many, many times before. After Blair Witch came out, the Blair Witch Project in 1999, I want to say, there were so many found footage movies, and they were all so bad. Like, everything was trying to capture that, like, ooh, is this real? Could this really happen? What are we actually watching? And they all look terrible because they could, because that was a feature and not a bug. And this one, they do it really, really well because you feel like you are truly watching a TV talk show from the mid-70s. The production design, the costume design,
they really get it right.
So many shades of orange. It looks so great, and the hairstyle, and so you truly feel like you're watching a show that would have aired then. But then what happens is so unpredictable, and the use of silence and pacing to build tension is really expert. So it feels to me like if the Blair Witch Project meets Network.
Wow.
In terms of how well they do
We're racking them up today.
Right? Yeah. And just to see David Desmalchin is one of those great classic that guy supporting players, featured players. He was in the Ant-Man movies. He's in Doom Part 1. He's in the Suicide Squad. If you see him, you're like, oh, right, he's that guy. And he has the thing with his eyes that makes him either warm and sweet and vulnerable or totally unsettling. And he gets to play both versions of that here as the affable talk show host, but also as this cunning guy behind the scenes who is manipulating everyone and desperate for popularity. So it's so well done, so tense. I dug it.
Oh, and it's supposed to be American or Australian TV.
It's an American TV show. Yeah. Right. And so you know, he's American, David Desmalchin, but these are Australian filmmaking brothers. I want to mention Ingrid Torelli, who plays the teenage girl who is supposedly possessed, is so good. And they accomplished a lot with what must have been a very low budget in terms of production design, in terms of makeup, visual effects, creature design, because stuff happens with her and it's very effective.
I really want to see this.
Go see it.
Yeah, Late Night with the Devil. It's in select theaters. It's rated R, and our final film of the week, Free Time. Comedy written and directed by Ryan Martin Brown. Peter.
Yeah, this is his first feature. It was shot in 10 days for, I'm sure, a micro budget. It kind of floats away as you're watching it, but it does have a fascinating core idea. The actor, Colin Burgess, plays a guy who has this boring desk job. And he just decides he's going to quit. He doesn't really know what he's going to do, but he's just going to find himself. I'm not sure it's entirely intentional, but there's really nothing to find in this character. He has no inner life. So he leaves his job, but he really doesn't know what he's doing. It's similar to the much better movie Lost in America, Albert Brooks.
Well, that's a classic.
You know, where but it's the same premise, really, that you know, you sort of leave that world to find yourself, and then you can't find yourself. The performances in it are quite lovely. Rajat Suresh, Jesse Pinnock. It has some nice, there's a wonderful bad date scene in it, but it doesn't really, you know, it should have been bigger than it is, but I guess when you shoot for 10 days and, you know, you just sort of take what you get. But it's promising. I would like to see another film by this director.
And that director and writer is Ryan Martin Brown. Free Time is unrated, and you can see the comedy at the Landmark Westwood in Westwood. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. We have much more to come on Film Week here on LAist 89.3.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.